Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Coming up, a look at CSIS's Global Networks 2030 report, looking at developing economies and emerging technologies. But first, joining us is our very own contributing editor, Christopher P. Cavas, one of the world's leading naval experts and writers, joining us to discuss the Navy's new exercises being conducted by the Third Fleet off Catalina Island in the Pacific, off San Diego. Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Always great to be here, Vago.
An absolute pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense on this, the 10th anniversary of the company's Iron Dome system. Chris, talk to us a little bit about what the Navy said about the exercises being conducted by Third Fleet to do manned, unmanned integration and plumb some issues associated with what the Navy's future unmanned fleet is going to look like and how it's going to interface with its manned fleet. This coming after some criticism after the Navy issued its roadmap for an unmanned fleet. You joined us when that came out, and there was some criticism from naval quarters on it. So what's the Navy doing exactly, right? Because some interesting fleet units are also involved, including the second of the Zumwalt class, the Michael Mansour, the stealthy destroyer.
So this is the largest unmanned exercise the Navy has ever carried out. And it is an integration of quite a large number of manned units, meaning ships with people on them and aircraft with people on them and ship and a submarine. And unmanned surface vessels and aircraft and some underwater capabilities. So it's a very big exercise. As you just said, the Michael Mansour, which is one of the second Zumwalt class, is out on this. There are five Aegis ships, four destroyers and a cruiser taking part. There are two littoral combat ships, a submarine, and an amphibious ship, the Anchorage, plus aircraft such as the P-8 Poseidon, E-2 Hawkeye, Growler, electronic warfare aircraft. And those are the manned assets. The unmanned stuff is the Sea Hunter is this medium displacement unmanned surface vessel that was unveiled several years ago. It's a very thin hull with outriggers that operates out of San Diego and is rarely seen. They rarely showcase it operating. They've been experimenting with it. It's done a number of unmanned voyages, including out to Pearl Harbor in Hawaii and back to San Diego with nobody on board. There's a second one now that was just delivered at the beginning of April, Seahawk. It was shipped out from the Gulf Coast, the Gulf of Mexico coast, as deck cargo, and the two of them are now operating together. They're almost identical. Right. That's the first time you've ever seen anything like that. That's pretty... even from a purely photographic point of view, very symbolic. They have MQ-8 fire scouts. There's this MQ-9 Sea Guardian, which is actually owned by General Atomics. There's another privately owned, very long, ultra-long flight endurance UAV called Vanilla, which is taking part. There are the Office of Naval Research has this Super Swarm project that is out there. There's a lot of things that are taking part. They're going to operate them in multiple scenarios.
And so what does the Navy want to accomplish at the end of it, right? I mean, obviously this is an evolutionary process. This gets to some of the criticism that the Navy actually doesn't really know what it wants to do. What does the Navy hope to accomplish after this, right? What are the to-do items that flow from this exercise?
So one of the questions is, can they break loose from their habit of over-classifying everything? And they are always nervous about, quote, you know, we're in a great power competition. We don't want to tell the other side too much. Well, you're not telling anybody too much. So their strategy was criticized for a lack of substance, an extreme lack of substance, lots of sloganeering. They're they're still doing a lot of that. We'll have to wait and see. It is difficult to get them to break to say specifically what are you going to be doing in this. So, for example, they did say they're having a big. There are three main components in this deal, in this big exercise. The question is how much will they then talk about it after the fact? So they're going to do a vignette, as it's known, on ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, on what can they do with essentially unmanned things, scouting and feeding data back to the manned units. There's going to be what they call a multi-domain integration exercise, which again is just operating with various manned and unmanned things. I'm not sure how much detail, I don't have a lot more detail than that. The highlight apparently will be an offensive missile shoot that will be an exercise. So one, they were reluctant to provide many more details on that other than to say it was an offensive shoot as opposed to a defensive. So they're going to try to target something. Probably they'll use these unmanned assets to provide offboard data to the ships with the shooters, with the missiles on them, which could be, frankly, anybody. There's six ships out here with missiles. Now, the big question becomes after the fact, how much will you tell us about that? Beyond saying it's all important and it's great and we make leaps and bounds forward and all this. Well, whoopee, what did you actually do? I don't know. We'll have to wait. That does remain to be seen.
That's the quote of the interview, Chris. Well, whoopee. You know, we're going to see how this plays out. New York Times wrote a comprehensive story about USS Eisenhower being in position to support the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Obviously, the United States always wants to make sure there's a carrier somewhere available to be able to project power as necessary. The deeper story is how carrier availability is improving. Talk to us a little bit about how that picture that was so grim, about a year ago, has dramatically changed. And, you know, right, I mean, kudos to the CNO when he tweeted out last year, you know, four carriers out, Hayes Gray and underway, providing presence around the world. Talk to us a little bit about what the carrier picture looks like going forward.
Well, there are always carriers in a rotation. So, you know, to say the U.S. is sending a carrier out to do this, well, almost all the time, except with singular exceptions, that is a regular rotation. So the Dwight D. Eisenhower is deployed right now and operating in the Arabian Sea, Persian Gulf region. The Theodore Roosevelt is out right now operating in the South China Sea. The next carrier to go is the California-based Carl Vinson, who will deploy late this summer. That will be in time, by the way, to cover the announced September 11th withdrawal date. That's an interesting deployment. That actually will feature the first F-35C, the carrier-based variant of the Joint Strike Fighter, in an operational cruise. They're going out. The Ronald Reagan, which is based in Japan, has been in maintenance all winter. She's coming out of that now. She will make her cruise. Actually, this fall, they'll have two carriers available in that region per the regular rotation. So it won't be an exception. I don't see why they would have to keep the Eisenhower or Teddy Roosevelt longer right now.
And for another couple of days, Eisenhower is under command of French Rear Admiral Marc Ossedat, who's aboard the French nuclear-powered aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle.
Right. So Charles de Gaulle is on a very interesting deployment called Clemenceau 21, major task group. They left in February from Toulon. As you well know, a great opportunity tomorrow to talk to them. They're operating she's the flagship of Combined Task Force 50 right now, which is an international group operating on the Fifth Fleet and the Central Command in the Persian Gulf, Arabian Sea region. Very significant deployment for the French.
Absolutely. And we're really looking forward and hope we can pull it off to get that interview with Admiral Ossedat. Certainly going to be an honor and pleasure. Chris, thanks so very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure and look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Margo.
And joining us now is John Hillman, a senior fellow in the economics program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he's also the director of the Reconnecting Asia Project. He's also the co-author with Laura Rivas of the new report, Global Networks 2030, Developing Economies and Emerging Technologies. John served in the Obama administration as a policy advisor to then U.S. Trade Representative Mike Froman. John, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thoughtful report. Obviously, China is looming large in the Biden administration's strategy to confront Beijing on everything from human rights, rule of law, trade practices. Chinese officials have been pretty visionary in their ability to focus technology investment, seeing 5G as something, for example, among the battery of digital technologies they've been working on. Some interesting financial technologies, and certainly looking to supplant at some point, maybe even the dollar, as digital currencies become more popular. They've got the Belt and Road Initiative, the Digital Silk Road, and a number of other efforts. The Biden administration is making clear and certainly making its case for its $2.2 trillion infrastructure investment plan, responding to critics that say that this has got to go far beyond sort of classical roads and bridges and cover digital technologies, quantum, cyber, 5G, and what have you. You guys lay out sort of the global technological and trade landscape. Talk to us about sort of the key features, right? I mean, where are we? Because I think Americans have a tendency of thinking we're the best, we're the best, we're the best, and we're ahead of everybody. And I think that that dynamic has dramatically been changing over the past decade. Where are we now? Where are we going?
Thanks. So, the goal of this report, or sort of the launching off point for it, was to try to imagine what global networks would look like in 2030. And so, 10 years is, or 9 years is a long time to look ahead. And the goal here isn't to, have a crystal ball and exactly predict the future, but to try to grapple with some of the trends we see emerging so that we're better prepared with policy. And, I think we're living now in a world where we didn't do that adequately a decade ago. We're living in a world where, there are Chinese suppliers of these increasingly important systems, Huawei and 5G, but none of that happened overnight. And so I think, the good news is that I think policymakers now understand that the telecom sector is not just economically important, but also strategically important. But we still need to, look ahead. We need to decide, what are the key technologies. But we also need to think about what are the key markets. And so that's really one of the major themes that comes out of this report as we're looking ahead. 2030, we're going to be looking at markets in Asia, Africa, and Latin America playing an even more central role. Urbanization is going to drive some of that. But it's really, the United States can't sort of confine itself to just doing business in rich democracies. We've seen a little bit of that as sort of the first phase of a strategy on 5G. We really need to compete in developing and emerging markets because frankly, that's where the world's population growth is going to happen. That's where, a lot of economic growth is going to be happening. And that's where China is doubling down right now.
So when we look at this competitive dynamic, right, China has gone in very, very short order to being a leading trading partner across the world, right? I mean, something like 60 something nations count China as their number one trading partner. Only 30 or so count the United States as their leading trading partner. Their number two trading partner is China, right? So the number is actually really big if you go to one and two. And China has been very, very aggressive. A little bit as we were during the Cold War in Latin America, as well as in Asia, as you mentioned, where 7 out of 10 people are going to be living in city centers, and a lot of that growth is in Asia and Africa. And in Washington, we have these absurd battles on foreign aid and how to basically try to constrain it, whereas the Chinese have a different approach. What are elements of the Chinese approach that make sense that we ought to be emulating to try to engage more closely around the world in what is a true global competition for influence and resources?
Yeah, so you're right that China is playing a larger role as a leading trading nation and also a leading lender. I think it's telling that last year in the aftermath of the pandemic, when there were about 100 countries going to the IMF for debt relief, for most of them, China was their largest bilateral official creditor. And China's lending activity has not been done at international standards. It's been done you know, with a very opaque way of operating. It's created a lot of risks in some of these markets. And so I think it's important to first acknowledge some of the downsides of this activity. But there's an appeal to it. China is putting forward a vision. Part of this is through the Belt and Road Initiative, which now includes 140 countries that have agreed to participate in it in one way or another. China is putting forward a vision that's speaking to the aspirations of developing countries, which really need investment. They need infrastructure. And for many of them, China's not their first choice, but at the end of the day, it's often the only choice. And so I think you see China gaining ground in some of those economies, many of which are now even more limited in terms of their fiscal situation, and sort of, you know, now more vulnerable, frankly, to outside influence. So China has been taking advantage of a real demand globally for investment, and particularly for infrastructure.
And so how do we need to think about what U.S. strategies look like in this context, right? And not everything China does is good, but right, they're investing in the right technologies. They have a strategic approach. They're trying to scratch itches all around the world that we've basically been ignoring, right? I mean, we like to sermonize countries and restrict aid and do a whole bunch of other things, whereas the Chinese basically like to tell leaders around the world they don't really care what their human rights record is ultimately, right? I mean, that's another dynamic of this. But what are the elements of what a cogent strategy, John, looks like if we're going to be actually competing in all of these places?
So I think it starts with putting forward, you know, an alternative vision. And it doesn't need to be framed in opposition to China. I think it should be done in a way that draws a contrast implicitly to what China is doing. But, you know, the U.S. needs to put forward its own vision. I think it's doing this in a way when it talks about a free and open Indo-Pacific. I think that there's opportunities to build on that. I think the goal here is to do something that, first of all, is going to benefit Americans. So I think we can be self-interested when we do this. We want to align this vision with key partners and allies. And so, you know, I think there's an opportunity to do that with Japan, Australia, the EU, and others, potentially India through the Quad. And then we need to be offering something that's appealing to the aspirations of these developing and emerging markets. And I think, frankly, what the United States has to offer is not going to be the same thing that China has to offer in all these places. China has 7 of the world's 10 largest construction companies. These are state-owned enterprises that have basically become bloated and, you know, have built so much at home that they've essentially run out of things to build. The U.S. doesn't have that exact set of capabilities. That's not a bad thing, but we have other things to offer. And so in this report, one of the areas that we highlight that I think is really promising for cooperation among partners and allies in competing with China is a set of technologies that's often referred to as smart cities. So there's no definition for exactly, you know, there's no one size fits all model for a smart city. But this includes remote sensing, it includes data analytics, it includes improvements in everything from garbage collection to internet and communication service, smarter traffic systems that, you know, are going to, make daily life better for people living in these urban environments. China's version of an offering for that is really heavily focused on surveillance and security. And that's appealing to some countries who face significant crime. But if you look at these Chinese examples, I think there's room for questioning whether they're actually delivering the benefits they promise above and beyond some of the human rights concerns that they raise. And so I think the U.S. has an opportunity here, again, working with partners and allies, to offer a smart city package that is both more socially responsible and actually delivers the economic benefits that it promises.
Singapore is another leader in some of these smart city technologies at the end of the day. And it's interesting that countries that want to maintain some form of order tend to be a little bit better at it than countries that are somewhat less interested in imposing that order. And I think anybody who would look at a lot of major metropolitan areas in the United States and certainly conclude there have got to be better ways of doing this. As somebody who spends quite a lot of time, at least over the last year, not so much, but generally a lot of time in DC traffic, I can figure out, I could easily see there are better ways to sort of do this. Countering Chinese technology is a big challenge. China invested, for example, Huawei invested a lot of money in 5G, certainly had made enormous inroads with our allies and partners, including allied and partner militaries for NATO nations, where there was a lot of reliance on Huawei gear. The Trump administration made a big issue of this, but the solution, right, at the end of the day, it was a dissuasive strategy as opposed to a persuasive strategy, one of sanctioning allies and partners. What's the right way to press ahead, given that some of our U.S. friends, whether they're Finnish or Swedish, for example, whether it's Ericsson or Nokia, has technology. Some United States companies have invested in this as well. What's the right way to proceed as fellow liberal democracies in the development of some core enabling technology and do it in a concerted partnership fashion as opposed to a dissuasive strategy?
Yeah, I think that there's both an economic dimension to this that's really important as well as a technological dimension. You know, on the economic side, I think you're pointing out that you can't compete if you're not bringing, an alternative to the table, and an alternative that's realistic, competitive, affordable. The security argument alone is not going to dissuade enough countries. I think we saw, initial resistance among, even countries that are formal allies, that are rich democracies who were hesitant to want to pay more for more secure, reliable communication systems. And so if you imagine that basic challenge, and then imagine that in a country with fewer resources, which isn't a formal ally, in order to make that case and to, I think, really change things on the ground, you do need an alternative. And so, you mentioned Nokia and Ericsson are providers. I think there's also promising work being done right now with Open RAN, which is, an alternative approach to building these networks that would move away from this sort of one vendor supplies everything model to a more open environment, as the name implies, in which you could use components from different vendors, many of whom, the competitive companies in this space include some smaller US companies, as well as some companies from Japan and South Korea. And so there's exciting things, I think, going on there. The technology, it's not there today, but, 3 years, it could be in a stronger position. And this is the type of thing, too, that we could, by, using a U.S. domestic infrastructure package well, we could scale some of this and have more successful examples to point to, which would help these U.S. companies export abroad, would help us compete with China and some of these other markets.
As somebody who is in the international trade business, right, I mean, there's always a fine line on what are national critical elements of a strategy and what's just downright protectionism, right? And there's this concern that the Trump administration was talking about, buy American and America first, and that actually the Biden administration in some very subtle ways may be doing this as well. What's the key to looking out for the interests of American industry and U.S. national security and economic interests, while at the same time benefiting from a more robust and competitive global trade order that actually is what keeps the whole ball rolling in a positive virtuous cycle, right? I mean, why would we reinvent a wheel that our allies have already invented?
Yes, I think you're right. There's a tension, or can be a tension sometimes, among these competing objectives. I mean, I think the important place to start is just, you know, which of these decisions is going to benefit, you know, the American middle class. I think that's where the Biden administration is. I think that's its starting point right now. But there is this international dimension, and so I think we want to be making investments. We want to be using our, you know, limited public resources in ways that position the U.S. to be more competitive internationally, because this really is a competition. I think, you know, one of the themes of this this report, Global Networks 2030, is that, you know, China is moving ahead quite quickly in some of these other markets. And so, you know, the U.S. does have these domestic challenges right now, but if we address those in the right way, we're going to come out of this not only stronger, but really better prepared to compete in some of these other areas. And so, you know, I think a lot of this is going to come down to looking at individual cases. There's also some sensitivities too around technology and wanting to have some export controls, especially as we're looking at higher end capabilities. I think one of the lessons of the last 10 years, 20 years, even longer, you know, is that we should be cautious about, you know, pursuing some of these capabilities in ways that are transferring them, you know, inadvertently to, you know, companies that are going to become our competitors.
Let's talk a little bit about the Digital Silk Road. Talk to us about the initiative, because I think people have a tendency of knowing about the Belt and Road, but not as much about the Digital Silk Road component, and how the United States needs to respond.
So this is something that's, you know, it was announced as sort of a subcomponent of the Belt and Road Initiative. The Belt and Road Initiative was announced in 2013. It's Xi Jinping's signature foreign policy vision. And the first reference to the Digital Silk Road was in 2015. It was actually referred to as the Information Silk Road at that point. And then subsequent references to it, sort of as everything does in the Belt and Road, expanded the definition to include other activities. But it's, you know, it's basically digital infrastructure, and it's China's understanding of the economic opportunity and the strategic importance of building, designing, and operating networks. And so, you know, everything from subsea cables, which, you know, carry 95% of the world's international data, to the data centers that those cables often feed into, to wireless networks, like we were talking about earlier, to smart city or safe city equipment, and even some satellite activities. All of that falls under this broad Digital Silk Road banner. And I think it's something that's going to become even more important in the aftermath of the pandemic, because if we, again, imagine the financial situation that a lot of developing economies now face, you know, they have less fiscal space to borrow to do the large transport and energy projects that really characterize the first phase of the Belt and Road. And so these digital projects, while they're not cheap, they're a little bit more feasible in that sense. They're also often faster to deliver, faster to complete. And I think if the pandemic has showed us anything, it's that, you know, you don't want to be on a losing side of the digital divide. You know, we're all of us are more and more dependent on these digital infrastructure systems every day, even though a lot of it is out of sight, out of mind. And so I think we're seeing China go into these emerging markets. In doing so, I think it's positioning itself to really benefit from the population growth in these places, and it's setting itself up to succeed, even if it is no longer has access to the advanced economies that its companies once dreamed of succeeding in.
John, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Commend folks to check out the report and also check out your online event that Matthew Goodman who heads the Asia and Economics arms of CSIS was the moderator of. Thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.